then looked up and broke into a broad smile, none the less charming for missing half its teeth.
"Why, you'll maybe be a yarb woman, won't you?"
"I will." He turned my hand gently over, tracing the chlorophyll stains around my cuticles.
"A green-fingered lady might just be tending her roses, but a lady whose hands smell of sassafras root and Jesuit bark is like to know more than how to make flowers bloom. Don't you reckon that's so?"
he asked, turning a friendly gaze on Ian, who was viewing Mr. Myers with unconcealed interest.
"Oh, aye," Ian assured him. "Auntie Claire's a famous healer, a wise woman."
He glanced proudly at me.
"That's so, boy. Well, now."
Mr. Myers' eyes went round with interest and swiveled back to focus on me.
"Smite me if this ain't Lucifer's own luck, and me thinking I'd have to wait till I come to the mountains and find me a shaman to take care of it."
"Are you ill, Mr. Myers?" I asked. He didn't look it, but it was hard to tell, what with the beard, the hair, and a thin layer of greasy brown dirt that seemed to cover everything not concealed by his ragged buckskins. The sole exception was his forehead, normally protected from the sun by the black felt hat. It was now exposed to view, a wide, flat slab of purest white.
"Not to say ill, I don't reckon," he replied.
He suddenly stood up and began to fumble up the tail of his buckskin shirt.
"It ain't the clap, or the French pox, anyhow. 'Cause I seen those before."
What I had thought were trousers were, in fact, long buckskin leggings, surmounted by a breech clout. Still talking, Mr. Myers had hold of the leather thong holding up this latter garment, and was fumbling with the knot.
"Damnedest thing, though. All of a sudden this great big swelling come up just along behind my balls. Purely inconvenient, as you may imagine, though it don't hurt me none to speak of. Save on horseback. Might be you could take a peep and tell me what I best do for it, hm?"
"Ah," I said, with a frantic glance at Fergus, who merely shifted his sack of beans and looked amused, blast him.
"Would I have the pleasure to meet the acquaintance of Mr. John Myers?" said a polite Scottish voice over my shoulder.
Mr. Myers ceased fumbling with his breech clout and glanced up inquiringly.
"Can't say whether it's a pleasure to you or not, sir," he replied courteously. "But be you looking for Myers? You've found him."
Jamie stepped up beside me, tactfully inserting his body between me and Mr. Myers' breech clout. He bowed formally, hat under his arm.
"James Fraser, your servant, sir. I was told to offer the name of Mr. Hector Cameron by way of introduction."
Mr. Myers looked at Jamie's red hair with interest.
"Scotch, are you? Be you one of them Highlander fellows?"
"I am a Scotsman, aye, and a Highlander."
"Be you kin to old Hector Cameron?"
"He is my uncle by marriage, sir, though I have not met him myself. I was told that he was well known to you, and that you might consent to guide my party to his plantation."
The two men were frankly sizing each other up, eyes flicking head to toe as they talked, appraising bearing, dress, and armament. Jamie's eyes rested approvingly on the long sheath knife at the woodsman's belt, while Mr. Myers' nostrils flared wide with interest.
"Comme deux chiens,"
Fergus remarked softly behind me. "Like two dogs."
"Au cul."
"Next thing you know, they'll be smelling each other's backside." Mr. Myers darted a glance at Fergus, and I saw a quick flash of amusement in the hazel depths before he returned to his assessment of Jamie. Uncultured the woodsman might be, but he plainly had some working knowledge of French. Given Mr. Myers' olfactory inclinations and lack of self-consciousness, I might not have been surprised to see him drop to all fours and perform in the manner Fergus had suggested. As it was, he contented himself with a careful inspection that took in not only Jamie, but Ian, Fergus, myself, and Rollo.
"Nice dog," he said casually,
holding out a set of massive knuckles to the latter. Rollo, thus invited, instituted his own inspection, sniffing industriously from moccasins to breech clout as the conversation went on.
Your uncle, eh? Does he know you're coming?
Jamie shook his head.
I canna say. I sent a letter from Georgia a month ago, but I've no way to tell whether he's had it yet.
I shouldn't think so, Myers said thoughtfully.
His eyes lingered on Jamie's face, then passed swiftly over the rest of us.
I've met your wife. This'll be your son.
He nodded at Ian.
My nephew, Ian. My foster son, Fergus.
Jamie made the introductions with a wave of his hand.
And a friend, Duncan Innes, who'll be along presently.
Myers grunted, nodding, and made up his mind.
Well, I should reckon I can get you to Cameron's, all right. Wanted to be sure you was kin. But you got the look of the widder Cameron in the face. The boy some, too.
Jamie's head jerked up sharply.
The widow Cameron.
A sly smile flitted through the thicket of beard.
Old Hector caught the morbid sore throat up and died late last winter. Don't figure they get much mail, wherever he is now.
Abandoning the Camerons for matters of more immediate personal interest, Myers resumed his interrupted excavations.
Big purple thing, he explained to me, fumbling his loosened thong. Almost as big as one of my balls. You don't think it might could be as I've decided sudden-like to grow an X-tree, do you?
Well, no, I said, biting my lip. I really doubt it. He moved very slowly, but had almost got the knot in his thong undone. People in the street were beginning to pause, staring. Please don't trouble yourself, I said. I do believe I know what that is. It's an inguinal hernia. The wide hazel eyes got wider.
It is.
He seemed impressed and not at all displeased by the news. I'd have to look, somewhere indoors, that is, I added hastily, to be sure. But it sounds like it. It's quite easy to repair surgically, but... I hesitated, looking up at the colossus. I really couldn't. I mean, you'd need to be asleep. Unconscious, I amplified. I'd have to cut you and sew you up again, you see. Perhaps a truss, a brace, might be better, though. Myers scratched slowly at his jaw, meditating.
No, I done tried that. 'Twon't do. Cutting, though. You folks be staying here in the town for a spell before you head up to Cameron's.
Not long, Jamie interrupted firmly. We shall be sailing up river to my aunt's estate as soon as passage can be arranged.
Oh.
The giant pondered this for a moment, then nodded, beaming.
I know the very man for you, sir. I'll go this minute and fetch Josh Freeman out of the sailor's rest. Sun's still high. You'll not be too drunk to do business yet.
He swept me a bow.
And then could be your wife might have the kindness to meet me in yonder tavern. It's a mite more genteel than the sailors. And have a look at this. This.
I saw his lips try to form themselves around inguinal hernia, then give up the effort and relax.
This year, obstruction.
He clapped the hat back on his head, and with a nod to Jamie, was off. Jamie watched the mountain man's stiff-legged retreat down the street, slowed by cordial greetings to all he passed.
"What is it about you, Sassenach, I wonder?"
he said conversationally, eyes still fixed on Myers. "What is what about me?" He turned then and gave me a narrow eye.
"What is it that makes every man you meet want to take off his breeks within 5 minutes of meeting you?"
Fergus choked slightly, and Ian went pink. I looked as demure as possible.
"Well, if you don't know, my dear," I said. No one does.
I seem to have found us a boat. And what have you been up to this morning? Industrious as always, Jamie had found us a potential gem buyer. And not only a buyer, but an invitation to dinner with the governor.
Governor Tryon's in the town just now, he explained. Staying at the house of a Mr. Lillington. I talked this morning with a merchant named McEachern, who put me on to a man named MacLeod, who introduced you to McNeil, who took you to drink with MacGregor, who told you all about his nephew Bethune, who is the second cousin half-removed of the boy who cleans the governor's boots, I suggested, familiar by this time with the Byzantine pathways of Scottish business dealings. Put two Highland Scots in a room together, and within 10 minutes they would know each other's family histories for the last 200 years, and have discovered a helpful number of mutual relatives and acquaintances. Jamie grinned.
That was the governor's wife's secretary, he corrected, and his name's Murray. That'll be your da's cousin Maggie's eldest boy from Lochlinney, he added to Ian. His father emigrated after the Rising.
Ian nodded casually, doubtlessly docketing the information in his own version of the genetic encyclopedia, stored against the day it would prove useful. Edwin Murray, the governor's wife's secretary, had welcomed Jamie warmly as a kinsman, if only by marriage, and had obtained an invitation for us to dine at Lillington's that night, there, ostensibly, to acquaint the governor with matters of trade in the Indies. In reality, we were intending to acquaint ourselves with Baron Pensler, a well-to-do German nobleman who would be dining there as well. The Baron was a man not only of wealth, but of taste, with a reputation as a collector of fine objects.
"Well, it sounds a good idea," I said dubiously, "but I think you'd better go alone. I can't be dining with governors looking like this."
"Ah, you look f—"
His voice faded as he actually looked at me. His eye roamed slowly over me, taking in my grimy, bedraggled gown, wild hair, and ragged bonnet. He frowned at me.
"No, I want you there, Sassenach. I may need a distraction."
"Speaking of distraction, how many pints did it take you to wangle an invitation to dinner?" I asked, mindful of our dwindling finances.
Jamie didn't blink, but took my arm, turning me toward the row of shops.
6, but he paid half. "Come along, Sassenach. Dinner's at 7, and we must find you something decent to wear."
"But we can't afford—"
"It's an investment," he said firmly. "And besides, Cousin Edwin has advanced me a bit against the sale of a stoon."
The gown was 2 years out of fashion by the cosmopolitan standards of Jamaica, but it was clean, which was the main thing so far as I was concerned.
"You're dripping, madam."
The sempstress's voice was cold. A small, spare woman of middle age, she was the preeminent dressmaker in Wilmington and, I gathered, accustomed to having her fashion dictates obeyed without question. My rejection of a frilled cap in favour of freshly washed hair had been received with bad grace and predictions of pleurisy, and the pin she held in her mouth bristled like porcupine quills at my insistence on replacing the normal heavy corsetry with light boning, scalloped at the top, to lift the breasts without pinching them.
"Sorry."
I tucked up the offending wet lock inside the linen towel that wrapped my head. The guest quarters of Mr. Lillington's great house being fully occupied by the governor's party, I had been relegated to Cousin Edwin's tiny attic over the stable block, and the fitting of my gown was being accomplished to the accompaniment of muffled stampings and chewings from below, punctuated by the monotonous strains of the groom's whistling as he mucked out the stalls. Still, I wasn't inclined to complain. Mr. Lillington's stables were a deal cleaner than the inn where Jamie and I had left our companions, and Mrs. Lillington had very graciously seen me provided with a large basin of hot water and a ball of lavender-scented soap, a consideration more important even than the fresh dress. I hoped never to see another peach. I rose slightly on my toes, trying to see out of the window in case Jamie should be coming, but desisted at a grunt of protest from the sempstress, who was trying to adjust the hem of my skirt. The gown itself wasn't at all bad. It was of cream silk, half-sleeved and very simple, but with panniers of wine-striped silk over the hips, and a ruching of claret-coloured silk piping that ran in 2 rows from waist to bosom.
With the Brussels lace I had purchased sewn around the sleeves, I thought it would do, even if the cloth wasn't quite of the first quality. I had at first been surprised at the price, which was remarkably low, but now observed that the fabric of the dress was coarser than usual, with occasional slubs of thickened thread that caught the light in shimmers. Curious, I rubbed it between my fingers. I was no great judge of silk, but a Chinese acquaintance had spent most of one idle afternoon on board a ship, explaining to me the lore of silkworms and the subtle variation of their output. "Where does this silk come from?" I asked. "It isn't China silk. Is it French?" The sempstress looked up, her crossness temporarily relieved by interest. "No, indeed it's not. That's made in South Carolina, that is. There's a lady, Mrs. Pinckney by name, has gone and put half her land to mulberry trees and went to raising silkworms on 'em. The cloth's maybe not quite so fine as the China," she acknowledged reluctantly, "but 'tisn't but half the cost either." She squinted up at me, nodding slowly. "It'll do for fit, and the bit of piping's good, brings out the colour in your cheeks. But, begging your pardon, madam, you do need something above the neck, not to look too bare. If you won't have a cap, nor a wig, might be you'd have a ribbon." "Oh, ribbon," I said, remembering. "Yes, what a good idea. Do look in my basket over there, and you'll find a length that might just do." Between us, we managed to get my hair piled up, loosely bound with a length of dark pink ribbon, damp curly tendrils coming down. I couldn't stop them, round my ears and brow. "Not too much mutton dressed as lamb, is it?" I asked, suddenly worried. I smoothed the hand down the front of the bodice, but it fit snugly and trimly around my waist. "Oh, no, madam," the sempstress assured me. "Quite appropriate, and I say it myself." She frowned at me, calculating. "Only it is a bit bare over the bosom still. You haven't any jewellery at all?"
"Just this."
We turned in surprise as Jamie ducked his head to come in the door. Neither of us had heard him coming. He had somewhere managed to have a bath and procure a clean shirt and neckcloth. Beyond that, someone had combed and plaited his hair into a smooth queue, bound with a new blue silk ribbon. His serviceable coat hadn't only been brushed, but improved by the application of a set of silver gilt buttons, each delicately engraved with a small flower in the centre. "Very nice," I said, touching one.
"Rented from the goldsmith," he said. "But they'll do. So will this, I think."
He drew out a filthy handkerchief from his pocket, from the folds of which he produced a slender gold chain.
"He hadn't time for any but the simplest mount," he said, frowning in concentration as he fastened the chain around my neck. "But I think that's best, don't you?"
The ruby hung glinting just above the hollow of my breasts, casting a pale rosy glow against my white skin. "I'm glad you picked that one," I said, touching the stone gently. It was warm from his body. "Goes much better with the dress than the sapphire or the emerald would." The sempstress's jaw hung slightly open. She glanced from me to Jamie, her impression of our social position evidently going up by leaps and bounds. Jamie had finally taken time to notice the rest of my costume. His eyes travelled slowly over me from head to hem, and a smile spread across his face.
"You make a very ornamental jewel-box, Sassenach," he said. "A fine distraction, aye?"
He glanced out the window, where a pale peach colour stained a hazy evening sky, then turned to me, bowed, and made a leg.
"Might I claim the pleasure of your company for dinner, madam?"
Chapter 7. Great Prospects Fraught with Peril. While I was familiar with the 18th-century willingness to eat anything that could be physically overpowered and dragged to the table, I didn't subscribe to the mania for presenting wild dishes as though they hadn't, in fact, undergone the intermediary processes of being killed and cooked before making their appearance at dinner. I thus viewed the large sturgeon with which I sat eyeball to eyeball with a marked lack of appetite. Complete not only with eyes, but with scales, fins, and tail, the 3-foot fish rode majestically on waves of roe in aspic, decorated with a vast quantity of tiny spiced crabs, which had been boiled whole and scattered artistically over the platter. I took another large sip of wine, and turned to my dinner companion, trying to keep my eyes off the bulging glare of the sturgeon by my elbow.
"The most impertinent fellow," Mr. Stanhope was saying, by way of describing a gentleman he had encountered in a post-house whilst on his way to Wilmington from his property near Newbern. "Why, in the very midst of our refreshment he began to speak of his piles, and what torment they caused him with the coach's continual bouncing. And then, damn me, if the crude fellow didn't pull his kerchief out of his pocket, all spotted with blood, to show the company by way of evidence. Quite destroyed my appetite, ma'am, I assure you," he assured me, forking up a substantial mouthful of chicken fricassee.
He chewed it slowly, regarding me with pale, bulging eyes that reminded me uncomfortably of the sturgeons. Across the table, Philip Wiley's long mouth twitched with amusement.
"Take care your conversation doesn't incur a similar effect, Stanhope," he said, with a nod at my untouched plate. "Though a certain crudeness of company is one of the perils of public transport, I do admit."
Stanhope sniffed, brushing crumbs from the folds of his neckcloth.
"Needn't put on airs, Wiley. It's not everyone can afford to keep a coachman, especially not with all these fresh taxes. New ones stuck on every time one turns around, I do declare."
He waved his fork indignantly.
"Tobacco, wine, brandy, all very well. But a tax upon newspapers, have you heard the like? Why, my sister's oldest boy was awarded a degree from Yale University a year past."
He puffed his chest unconsciously, speaking just slightly louder than usual.
"And damned if she wasn't required to pay half a shilling, merely to have his diploma officially stamped."
"But that is no longer the case at present," Cousin Edwin said patiently, "since the repeal of the Stamp Act."
Stanhope plucked one of the tiny crabs from the platter and brandished it at Edwin in accusation.
"Get rid of one tax and another pops up in its place directly. Just like mushrooms."
He popped the crab into his mouth and was heard to mumble something indistinctly about taxing the air next, he shouldn't wonder.
"You are come but recently from the Indies, I understand, Madam Fraser."
Baron Pensler, on my other side, seized the momentary opportunity to interrupt.
"I doubt you will be familiar with such provincial matters or interested in them," he added, with a nod of benevolent dismissal at Stanhope.
"Oh, surely everyone is interested in taxes," I said, turning slightly sideways so as to display my bosom to best effect. "Or don't you believe that taxes are what we pay for a civilized society? Though having heard Mr. Stanhope's story," I nodded to my other side, "perhaps he would agree that the level of civilization isn't quite equal to the level of taxation."
"Ha ha!"
Stanhope choked on his bread, spewing crumbs.
"Oh, very good. Not equal to... No, certainly not."
Philip Wiley gave me a look of sardonic acknowledgement.
"You must try not to be so amusing, Mrs. Fraser," he said. "It may be the death of poor Stanhope."
What is the current rate of taxation, do you think?" I asked, tactfully drawing attention away from Stanhope's spluttering. Wiley pursed his lips, considering. A dandy, he wore the latest in modish wigs, and a small patch in the shape of a star beside his mouth. Under the powder, though, I thought I detected both a good-looking face and a very shrewd brain.
"Oh, considering all incidentals, I should say it can amount to as much as 2% of all income, if one was to include the taxes on slaves. Add taxes on lands and crops, and it amounts to a bit more, perhaps."
2%! Stanhope choked, pounding himself on the chest. "Iniquitous! Simply iniquitous!"
With vivid memories of the last IRS form I had signed, I agreed sympathetically that a 2% tax rate was a positive outrage, wondering to myself just what had become of the fiery spirit of American taxpayers over the intervening 200 years. But perhaps we should change the subject, I said, seeing that heads were beginning to turn in our direction from the upper end of the table. After all, speaking of taxes at the governor's table is rather like talking of rope in the House of the Hanged, isn't it? At this, Mr. Stanhope swallowed a crab hole and choked in good earnest. His partner, on the other side, pounded him helpfully on the back, and the small black boy who had been occupied in swatting flies near the open windows was sent hastily to fetch water. I marked out a sharp, slender knife by the fish platter, just in case, though I hoped I shouldn't be compelled to perform a tracheotomy on the spot. It wasn't the kind of attention I was hoping to attract. Luckily, such drastic measures weren't required. The crab was disgorged by a fortunate slap, leaving the victim empurpled and gasping, but otherwise unharmed. "Someone had mentioned newspapers," I said, once Mr. Stanhope had been thus rescued from his excesses. "We've been here so short a time that I haven't seen any. Is there a regular paper printed in Wilmington?" I had ulterior motives for asking this, beyond a desire to allow Mr. Stanhope time to recover himself. Among the few worldly goods Jamie possessed was a printing press, presently in storage in Edinburgh. Wilmington, it appeared, had two printers in residence, but only one of these gentlemen, a Mr. Jonathan Gillette, produced a regular newspaper.
"And it may soon cease to be so regular," Stanhope said darkly. "I hear that Mr. Gillette has received a warning from the Committee of Safety that... Ah!"
He gave a brief exclamation, his plump face creased in pained surprise.
"Have you a particular interest, Mrs. Fraser?"
Wiley inquired politely,
darting a look under his brows at his friend. "I had heard that your husband had some connection with the printing trade in Edinburgh."
"Why, yes," I said, rather surprised that he should know so much about us.
"Jamie owned a printing establishment there, though he didn't issue a newspaper, books and pamphlets and plays and the like."
Wiley's finely arched brow twitched up.
"No political leanings, then, your husband. So often printers find their skills suborned by those whose passions seek outlet in print. But then, such passions are not necessarily shared by the printer."
That rang numerous alarm bells. Did Wiley actually know anything about Jamie's political connections in Edinburgh, most of whom had been thoroughly seditious? Or was this only normal dinner-table conversation? Judging from Stanhope's remarks, newspapers and politics were evidently connected in people's minds, and little wonder, given the times. Jamie, at the far end of the table, had caught his name and now turned his head slightly to smile at me, before returning to an earnest conversation with the governor, at whose right hand he sat. I wasn't sure whether this placement was the work of Mr. Lillington, who sat on the governor's left, following the conversation with the intelligent, slightly mournful expression of a basset hound, or of Cousin Edwin, consigned to the seat opposite me, between Philip Wiley and Wiley's sister, Judith.
"Oh, a tradesman,"
this lady now remarked in a meaningful tone of voice. She smiled at me, careful not to expose her teeth. "Likely decayed," I thought.
"And is this?"
She gave a vague wave at her head, comparing my ribbon to the towering confection of her wig. "The style in Edinburgh, Mrs. Fraser? How charming." Her brother gave her a narrowed eye.
"I believe I have also heard that Mr. Fraser is the nephew of Mrs. Cameron of River Run," he said pleasantly. "Have I been correctly informed, Mrs. Fraser?"
Cousin Edwin, who had undoubtedly been the source of this information, buttered his roll with sedulous concentration. Cousin Edwin looked very little like a secretary, being a tall and prepossessing young man with a pair of lively brown eyes, one of which now gave me the merest suggestion of a wink. The Baron, as bored with newspapers as with taxes, perked up a bit at hearing the name Cameron.
"River Run," he said. "You have relations with Mrs. Jocasta Cameron?"
"She's my husband's aunt," I replied. "Do you know her?"
"Oh, indeed, a charming woman, most charming."
A broad smile lifted the Baron's pendulous cheeks.
"Since many years, I am the dear friend of Mrs. Cameron and her husband, unfortunately dead."
The Baron launched into an enthusiastic recounting of the delights of River Run, and I took advantage of the lull to accept a small wedge of fish pie, full not only of fish, but of oysters and shrimps in a creamy sauce. Mr. Lillington had certainly spared no effort to impress the governor. As I leaned back for the footman to ladle more sauce onto my plate, I caught Judith Wiley's eyes on me, narrowed in a look of dislike that she didn't trouble to disguise. I smiled pleasantly at her, displaying my own excellent teeth, and turned back to the Baron, newly confident. There had been no looking-glass in Edwin's quarters, and while Jamie had assured me that I looked all right, his standards were rather different from those of fashion. I had received any number of admiring compliments from the gentlemen at table, true, but this might be no more than customary politeness. Extravagant gallantry was common among upper-class men. But Miss Wiley was 25 years my junior, fashionably gowned and jewelled, and if no great beauty, not plain either. Her jealousy was a better reflection of my appearance, I thought, than any looking-glass.
"Such a beautiful stone, Mrs. Fraser. You will permit me to look more closely?"
The Baron bent toward me, pudgy fingers delicately poised above my cleavage. "Oh, certainly," I said with alacrity, and quickly unclasped the chain, dropping the ruby into his broad, moist palm. The Baron looked slightly disappointed not to have been allowed to examine the stone in situ, but lifted his hand, squinting at the glinting droplet with the air of a connoisseur, which he evidently was, for he reached into his watch pocket and withdrew a small gadget that proved to be a combination of optical lenses, including both a magnifying glass and a jeweller's loop. I relaxed, seeing this, and accepted a helping of something hot and savoury-smelling from a glass dish being passed by the butler. What possessed people to serve hot food when the temperature in the room must be at least in the 90s?
"Beautiful," murmured the Baron, rolling the stone gently in his palm. "Sehr schön."
There were not many things about which I would have trusted Gillis Duncan, but I was sure of her taste in jewels.
"It must be a stone of the first class," she had said to me,
explaining her theory of time travel via gems.
"Large and completely flawless."
The ruby was large, all right, nearly the size of the pickled quail's eggs surrounding the fully plumed pheasant on the sideboard. As to its flawlessness, I felt no doubt. Gili had trusted this stone to carry her into the future. I thought it would probably get us as far as Cross Creek. I took a bite of the food on my plate. Some sort of ragout, I thought, very tender and flavourful. "How delicious this is," I said to Mr. Stanhope, lifting another forkful. "What is this dish, do you know?"
"Oh, it's one of my particular favourites, ma'am," he said,
inhaling beatifically over his own plate.
"Soused hog's face. Delectable, is it not?"
I shut the door of Cousin Edwin's room behind me and leaned against it, letting my jaw hang open in sheer relief at no longer being required to smile. Now I could take off the clinging dress, undo the tight corset, slip off the sweaty shoes. Peace, solitude, nakedness, and silence. I couldn't think of anything else required to make my life complete for the moment, save a little fresh air. I stripped off, and attired in nothing but my shift, went to open the window. The air outside was so thick, I thought I could have stepped out and floated down through it like a pebble dropped in a jar of molasses. The bugs came at once to the flame of my candle, light-crazed and blood-hungry. I blew it out, and sat on the window seat in the dark, letting the soft, warm air move over me. The ruby still hung at my neck, black as a blood drop against my skin. I touched it, set it swinging gently between my breasts. The stone was as warm as my own blood, too. Outside, the guests were beginning to depart. A line of waiting carriages was drawn up on the drive. The sounds of goodbyes, conversations, and soft laughter drifted up to me in snatches. "Quite clever," I thought, came up in Philip Wiley's cultured drawl.
"Oh, clever. Certainly it was clever."
His sister's higher-pitched tones made it quite clear what she thought of cleverness as a social attribute.
"Well, cleverness in a woman can be tolerated, my dear, so long as she is also pleasant to look upon. By the same token, a woman who has beauty may perhaps dispense with wit, so long as she has sense enough to conceal the lack by keeping her mouth shut."
Miss Wiley might not be accused of cleverness, but had certainly adequate sensibility to perceive the barb in this. She gave a rather unladylike snort.
"She is 1,000 years old, at least," she replied.
"Pleasant to look at, indeed. Though I will say it was a handsome trinket about her neck," she added grudgingly. "Oh, quite," said a deeper voice that I recognised as Lloyd Stanhope's. "Though, in my opinion, it was the setting rather than the jewel that was striking."
"Setting?" Miss Wiley sounded blank.
"There was no setting. The jewel merely rested upon her bosom."
"Really?" Stanhope said blandly. "I hadn't noticed."
Wiley burst out laughing, breaking off abruptly as the door opened to release more guests.
"Well, if you didn't, old man, there were others who did," he said with sly intonation. "Come, here's the carriage."
I touched the ruby again, watching the Wiley's handsome greys drive off. Yes, others had noticed. I could still feel the Baron's eyes on my bosom, knowingly avaricious. I rather thought he was a connoisseur of more than gems. The stone was warm in my hand. It felt warmer even than my skin, though that must be illusion. I didn't normally wear jewellery beyond my wedding rings, had never cared much for it. It would be a relief to be rid of at least part of our dangerous treasure. And still I sat there, holding the stone, cradling it in my hand, till I almost thought I could feel it beating like a small separate heart, in time with my blood. There was only one carriage left, its driver standing by the horses' heads. Some 20 minutes later, the occupant came out, adding to his goodbyes a good-humoured "Gute Nacht" as he stepped into his coach. The Baron. He had waited till last and was leaving in a good mood. That seemed a good sign. One of the footmen, stripped of his livery coat, was extinguishing the torches at the foot of the drive. I could see the pale blur of his shirt as he walked back to the house through the dark, and the sudden flare of light onto the terrace as a door opened to admit him below. Then that too was gone, and a night silence settled on the grounds. I had expected Jamie to come up at once, but the minutes dragged on with no sound of his step. I glanced at the bed, but felt no desire to lie down. At last, I stood up and slipped the dress back on, not bothering with shoes or stockings. I left the room, walking quietly down the hallway in my bare feet, down the stair, through the breezeway to the main house, and in through the side entrance from the garden. It was dark, save the pale squares of moonlight that came through the casements. Most of the servants must have retired, along with household and guests. There was a light glowing through the stairwell's banister, though. The sconces were still alight in the dining room beyond. I could hear the murmur of masculine voices as I tiptoed past the polished stair, Jamie's deep, soft Scots alternating with the governor's English tones in the intimate cadences of a tete-a-tete. The candles had burned low in their sconces. The air was sweet with melted beeswax, and low clouds of fragrant cigar smoke hung heavy outside the dining room doors. Moving quietly, I stopped just short of the door. From this vantage point, I could see the governor, back to me, neck stretched forward as he lit a fresh cigar from the candlestick on the table. If Jamie saw me, he gave no hint of it. His face bore its usual expression of calm good humour, but the recent lines of strain around eyes and mouth had eased, and I could tell from the slope of his shoulders that he was relaxed and at peace. My heart lightened at once. He had been successful, then.
"A place called River Run," he was saying to the governor, "well up in the hills, past Cross Creek." "I know the place," Governor Tryon remarked, a little surprised. "My wife and I passed several days in Cross Creek last year. We made a tour of the colony upon the occasion of my taking office. River Run is well up in the foothills, though, not in the town. Why, it's halfway to the mountains, I believe."
Jamie smiled and sipped his brandy.
"Aye, well," he said, "my family are Highlanders, sir. The mountains will be home to us." "Indeed."
A small puff of smoke rose over the governor's shoulder. Then he took the cigar from his mouth and leaned confidentially toward Jamie.
"Since we are alone, Mr. Fraser, there is another matter I wish to put before you. A glass with you, sir."
He picked up the decanter without waiting for an answer and poured more brandy.
Thank you, sir."
The governor puffed fiercely for a moment, sending up blue clouds, then, having got his weed well alight, sat back, cigar fuming negligently in one hand.
"You are very newly come to the colonies, young Edwin tells me. Are you familiar with the conditions here?"
Jamie shrugged slightly.
"I have made it my business to learn what are good, sir," he replied. "To which conditions might ye refer?" "North Carolina is a land of considerable richness," the governor answered, "and yet it hasn't reached the same level of prosperity as have its neighbours, owing mostly to a lack of labourers to take advantage of its opportunities. We have no great harbour for a seaport, you see. Thus slaves must be brought overland at great cost from South Carolina or Virginia, and we cannot hope to compete with Boston and Philadelphia for indentured labour. It has long been the policy both of the Crown and of myself, Mr. Fraser, to encourage the settlement of land in the colony of North Carolina by intelligent, industrious, and godly families to the furtherance of the prosperity and security of all."
He lifted his cigar, took a deep lungful, and exhaled slowly, pausing to cough.
"To this end, sir, there is established a system of land grants whereby a large acreage may be given to a gentleman of means, who will undertake to persuade a number of emigrants to come and settle upon a part of it under his sponsorship. This policy has been blessed with success over the last 30 years. A good many Highlanders and families from the Isles of Scotland have been induced to come and take up residence here. Why, when I arrived, I was astonished to find the banks of the Cape Fear River quite thick with McNeils, Buchanans, Grahams, and Campbells."
The governor tasted his cigar again, but this time the barest nip. He was anxious to make his point.
"Yet there remains a great deal of desirable land to be settled, further inland, toward the mountains. It is somewhat remote, and yet, as you say, for men accustomed to the far reaches of the Scottish Highlands..." "I did hear mention of such grants, sir," Jamie interrupted. "Yet is not the wording that persons holding such grants shall be white males, Protestant, and above 30 years of age, and this statement holds the force of law?" "That is the official wording of the Act, yes."
Mr. Tryon turned, so that I saw him now in profile, tapping the ash from his cigar into a small porcelain bowl. The corner of his mouth was turned up in anticipation. The face of a fisherman who feels the first twitch on his line.
"The offer is one of considerable interest," Jamie said formally. "But I must point out, however, that I am not a Protestant, nor are most of my kinsmen."
The governor pursed his lips in deprecation, lifting one brow.
"You are neither a Jew nor a Negro. I may speak as one gentleman to another, may I not? In all frankness, Mr. Fraser, there is the law, and then there is what is done.
He raised his glass with a small smile, setting the hook.
And I am convinced that you understand that as well as I do.
Possibly better,
Jamie murmured with a polite smile. The governor shot him a sharp look, but then uttered a quick bark of laughter. He raised his brandy glass in acknowledgement and took a sip.
We understand each other, Mr. Fraser, he said,
nodding with satisfaction. Jamie inclined his head a fraction of an inch.
There would be no difficulties raised, then, regarding the personal qualifications of those who might be persuaded to take up your offer.
None at all, said the governor, setting down his glass with a small thump.
Provided only that they are able-bodied men, capable of working the land. I ask nothing more. And what is not asked need not be told, eh?
One thin brow flicked up in query. Jamie turned the glass in his hands, as though admiring the deep colour of the liquid.
Not all who passed through a Stuart rising were so fortunate as myself, Your Excellency, he said. My foster's son suffered the loss of his hand. Another of my companions has but one arm. Yet they are men of good character and industry. I could not, in conscience, partake of a proposal which did not offer them some part.
The governor dismissed this with an expansive wave of the hand.
Provided that they are able to earn their bread and will not prove a burden upon the community, they are welcome.
Then, as though fearing he had been incautious in his generosity, he sat up straight, leaving the cigar to burn, propped on the edge of the bowl.
Since you mention Jacobites, these men will be required to swear an oath of loyalty to the crown, if they haven't already done so. If I might presume to ask, sir, as you imply you are papist, you, yourself.
Jamie's eyes might have narrowed only against the sting of the smoke, but I didn't think so. Neither did Governor Tryon, who was only in his 30s, but no mean judge of men. He swiveled to face the table again, so that I saw only his back, but I could tell that he was gazing intently at Jamie, eyes tracing the swift movements of the trout beneath the water.
"I do not seek to remind you of past indignity," he said quietly, "nor yet to offend present honour. Still, you will understand that it is my duty to ask."
Jamie smiled, quite without humour.
"And mine to answer, I expect," he said. "Yes, I am a pardoned Jacobite, and I have sworn the oath, like the others who paid that price for their lives."
Quite abruptly, he set down his still full glass and pushed back the heavy chair. He stood and bowed to the governor.
"It grows late, Your Excellency. I must beg to take my leave."
The governor sat back in his chair and lifted the cigar slowly to his lips. He drew heavily on it, making the tip glow bright as he gazed up at Jamie. Then he nodded, letting a thin plume of smoke drift from his pursed lips.
"Good night, Mr. Fraser. Do consider my offer, will you not?"
I didn't wait to hear the answer. I didn't need to. I skimmed down the hall in a rustle of skirts, startling a footman dozing in a dark corner. I made it back to our borrowed room in the stable block without meeting anyone else and collapsed. My heart was pounding, not only from the dash up the stairs, but from what I had heard. Jamie would consider the governor's offer all right. And what an offer! To regain in one swoop all that he had lost in Scotland, and more. Jamie hadn't been born a laird, but the death of his elder brother had left him heir to Lallybroch, and from the age of 8 he had been raised to take responsibility for an estate, to see to the welfare of land and tenants, to place that welfare above his own. Then had come Charles Stuart and his mad march to glory, a fiery cross leading his followers to shambles and destruction. Jamie had never spoken bitterly of the Stuarts, had never spoken of Charles Stuart at all, nor had he often spoken of what that venture had cost him personally. But now, to have that back. New lands, cultivable and rich with game, and settled by families under his sponsorship and protection. It was rather like the Book of Job, I thought. All those sons and daughters and camels and houses destroyed so casually, and then replaced with such extravagant largesse. I'd always viewed that bit of the Bible with some doubt myself. One camel was much like another, but children seemed a different proposition. And while Job might have regarded the replacement of his children as simple justice, I couldn't help thinking that the dead children's mother might possibly have been of another mind about it. Unable to sit, I went again to the window, gazing out unseeingly at the dark garden. It wasn't simply excitement that was making my heart beat fast and my hands perspire. It was fear. With matters as they were in Scotland, as they had been since the Rising, it would be no difficult matter to find willing emigrants. I had seen ships come into port in the Indies and in Georgia, disgorging their cargoes of emigrants, so emaciated and worn by their passage that they reminded me of nothing so much as concentration camp victims, skeletal as living corpses, white as maggots from 2 months in the darkness below decks. Despite the expense and difficulty of the journey, despite the pain of parting from friends and family and homeland forever, the immigrants poured in hundreds and in thousands, carrying their children, those who survived the voyage, and their possessions in small ragged bundles, fleeing poverty and hopelessness, seeking not fortune, but only a small foothold on life. Only a chance. I had spent only a short time at Lallybroch the winter before, but I knew there were tenants there who survived only by the goodwill of Ian and young Jamie, their crofts not yielding enough to live on. While such goodwill was invariably given, it wasn't inexhaustible. I knew that the estate's slender resources were often stretched to the maximum. Beyond Lallybroch, there were the smugglers Jamie had known in Edinburgh, and the illegal distillers of Highland whiskey. Any number of men, in fact, who had been forced to turn to lawlessness to feed their families. No, finding willing emigrants would be no problem at all for Jamie. The problem was that in order to recruit suitable men for the purpose, he would have to go to Scotland. And in my mind was the sight of a granite gravestone in a Scottish kirkyard, on a hill high above the moors and sea. James Alexander Malcolm Mackenzie Fraser, it read. And below that, my own name was carved, Beloved Husband of Claire. I would bury him in Scotland, but there had been no date on the stone when I saw it 200 years hence, no notion when the blow would fall. Not yet, I whispered, clenching my fist in the silk of my petticoat. I've only had him for a little while. Oh, God, please not yet. As though in answer, the door swung open, and James Alexander Malcolm Mackenzie Fraser came in, carrying a candle. He smiled at me, loosening his stock.
"You're very light on your feet, Sassenach. I see I must teach you to hunt one day, and you such a fine stalker."
I made no apology for eavesdropping, but came to help him with his waistcoat buttons. In spite of the late hour and the brandy, he was clear-eyed and alert, his body tautly alive when I touched him. "You'd best put out the candle," I said. "The bugs will eat you alive." I pinched a mosquito off his neck by way of illustration, the fragile body crushed to a smear of blood between my fingers. Among the scents of brandy and cigar smoke, I could smell the night on him, and the faint musky spice of Nicotiana. He'd been walking then, amid the flowers in the garden. He did that when he was either distressed or excited, and he didn't seem distressed. He sighed and flexed his shoulders as I took his coat. His shirt was damp with sweat underneath, and he plucked it away from his skin with a mild grunt of distaste.
"I canna tell how folk live in such heat dressed like this. It makes the savages look quite sensible to be going about in loincloths and aprons."
"It would be a lot cheaper," I agreed, "if less aesthetically appealing. Imagine Baron Pensler in a loincloth, I mean." The Baron weighed perhaps 18 stone, with a pasty complexion. He laughed, the sound muffled in his shirt as he pulled it over his head. You, on the other hand... I sat down on the window seat, admiring the view as he stripped off his breeches, standing on one leg to roll down his stocking. With the candle extinguished, it was dark in the room, but with my eyes adapted, I could still make him out, long limbs paled against the velvet night. And speaking of the Baron, I prodded. 300 pounds sterling, he replied, in tones of extreme satisfaction. He straightened up and tossed the rolled stockings onto a stool, then bent and kissed me. Which is in large part due to you, Sassenach. For my value as an ornamental setting, you mean? I asked dryly, recalling the Wiley's conversation. No, he said, rather shortly, for keeping Wiley and his friends occupied at dinner while I talked with the governor. Ornamental setting. Stanhope nearly dropped his eyeballs into your bosom, the filthy lecher. Had a mind to call him out for it, but... Discretion is the better part of valour, I said, standing up and kissing him back. Not that I've ever met a Scot who seemed to think so. Aye, well, there was my grandsire, old Simon. I suppose you could say it was discretion that did for him in the end. I could hear both the smile and the edge in his voice. If he seldom spoke of the Jacobites and the events of the Rising, it didn't mean he had forgotten. His conversation with the governor had obviously brought them close to the surface of his mind tonight. I'd say that discretion and deceit are not necessarily the same things. And your grandfather had been asking for it for 50 years at least, I replied tartly. Simon Fraser, Lord Lovett, had died by beheading on Tower Hill at the age of 78, after a lifetime of unparalleled chicanery, both personal and political. For all of that, I quite regretted the old rogue's passing.
Mm-hmm.
Jamie didn't argue with me, but moved to stand beside me at the window. He breathed in deeply, as though smelling the thick perfume of the night. I could see his face quite clearly in the dim glow of starlight. It was calm and smooth, but with an inward look, as though his eyes didn't see what was before them, but something else entirely. The past, I wondered. Or the future? What did it say? I asked suddenly. The oath you swore? I felt, rather than saw, the movement of his shoulders. Not quite a shrug.
I, James Alexander Malcolm Mackenzie Fraser, do swear, and as I shall answer to God at the great day of judgment, I have not, nor shall have in my possession, any gun, sword, pistol, or arm whatsoever, and never used tartan, plaid, or any part of the Highland garb. And if I do so, may I be cursed in my undertakings, family, and property.
He took a deep breath and went on, speaking precisely.
May I never see my wife and children, father, mother, or relations. May I be killed in battle as a coward, and lie without Christian burial, in a strange land, far from the graves of my forefathers and kindred. May all this come across me, if I break my oath.
And did you mind a lot? I said, after a moment.
No, he said softly, still looking out at the night. Not then. There are things worth dying or starving for, but not words.
Maybe not those words. He turned to look at me, features dim in the starlight, but the hint of a smile visible on his mouth.
You know of words that are?
The gravestone had his name, but no date. I could stop him going back to Scotland, I thought. If I would. I turned to face him, leaning back against the window frame. What about... I love you. He reached out a hand and touched my face. A breath of air stirred past us, and I saw the small hairs rise along his arm.
Aye, he whispered. That'll do.
There was a bird calling somewhere, close at hand. A few clear notes succeeded by an answer, a brief twitter, and then silence. The sky outside was still thick black, but the stars were less brilliant than before. I turned over.